Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is Thursday, July 24th, 2003. Today's session is Citizen Lobbying, a session in the series Politics and Public Policy, presented by John Marty. Let's listen in.
I'm John Marty. I'm a state senator from Minnesota and giving several talks on political and public policy things this week. And today I was asked if, because it's Jubilee Day and one of the projects today is writing letters to certain federal officials on third world debt, was asked if I would give a presentation on citizen lobbying. And I think the subtitle of it was how to have and make an impact without a lot of money or resources. And our whole political system is made with the premise that we're the ones who are the decision makers. We're the public, it's a government of the people. And there are many ways you can influence the political process. The two fundamental ways we're going to talk about, only one of them today, the two fundamental ways are, one, put people in the decision-making roles, put people in public office who will do the things you want. So that's the electoral half, making sure you get the right people in office. The second half, persuading those who hold the offices. Again, the debt relief effort that there's going to be a letter writing event this afternoon related to, they're writing to the U.S. Treasury Secretary, not an elected official, but because they're appointed by the president, nevertheless somehow accountable to the political process. And when you're trying to influence those who are holding office to support some concern you have, you as an individual, ordinary citizen, are at a big disadvantage to individuals or groups that have a lot of money, because that money translates to clout and power, not just in influencing people after they're elected, but also in determining who gets elected and who holds those offices. But when you look at who's in the U.S. House and Senate, who's in the president's office, who's in the your local state's governor and state legislators or county commissioners, that's a done deal right now. Until the next election, for whatever terms those are in place. So now, how do you influence them? How do you get them to share your concern? And as I said, you are at a disadvantage to somebody in any case, because if they have resources and you're one individual person. First thing to know then is that the more you can work with other people and have others who have the same kind of interest, the better off you're going to be. The whole nature of the postcard campaign that I believe they're doing this afternoon is the idea that a lot of postcards, a lot of people writing, a lot of people contacting government officials on it, sways them. There are other times, if you're the only one who cares about an issue or has an idea or something, you could spend years trying to build a public base of support, or you can appeal directly. So there are different ways of having an impact. When you're talking about persuading public officials, and much of this is just common sense. That's what I urge people to do when they're trying to persuade a public official. Use common sense. Pretend like you're the person getting the information, what's going to sway you. And the first thing you try and do in when there's an issue, whether it's a local school issue or a sewage issue or state level, maybe a tax policy or environmental issue, national level, military issue, war with Iraq, something like that. The first thing you may be doing, and at different levels, all of these things change. What you're trying to do to talk to a local county commissioner is going to be different than what you're trying to communicate to a U.S. senator, partly because your ability to access them is going to be a lot different. A county commissioner in a small county of 5,000 people is accountable to 5,000 people, which maybe 1,000, 2,000 households. They're going to remember you. You get 20 people to write the White House on something, and it's not even a blip on the charts. But what do you do when you're providing information? I think there's sort of about three basic things you might be doing depending on the issue. Providing information, facts, knowledge. I think the postcard campaign to Treasury Secretary Snow about third world debt for later today, I'm not going to speak to that like here because that's what they're doing at that time. But the factual information being provided there is pretty slim because in the postcard campaign, everybody's saying roughly the same thing. You're trying to get it by sheer volume and so on there. The second thing you try to provide information on is the facts and information, but also, in effect, an emotional appeal, not necessarily a sappy emotional appeal, but you tell stories, you let them connect with somehow. This makes a difference in so-and-so's life, or in our quality of life, or in the good of our community, or whatever. You spell it out. You make them think, here's why you might want to do this. So when I'm saying emotional appeal, yes, a tearjerker story might have more emotional appeal than one saying how it's not so such a tearjerker, but nevertheless, you're appealing to, here's the right thing to do, here's the emotional reason you're doing it. The third thing you might be able to do in providing information to a public official is provide some sort of vision. If you have a complaint, if Holden Village was a city, and you have a complaint about one of mine is because power is cheap here, lights are left on all the time here, it doesn't matter. Well, people go out of here and think, well, Holden is a place that's environmentally sensitive and they leave lights on. It doesn't make people think how to do it. And I always thought that there's a cross purposes here. There are cross purposes here like with the water. We're told, don't waste water, don't waste water. When I see somebody showering for 15 minutes, I'm thinking, wow, what about the water waste? But they look out the window and they see sprinklers running all day long, and there's the people who understand the system understand, hey, the input of water, there's, as long as railroad keeps flowing, we've got water, plenty of water. We can't possibly use it all up. And so outdoor uses of water, it's unlimited, but inside it goes down the sewage system and the septic field, and there's very tight limits. So I've often thought, well, I could spell out in a letter to the mayor, or in this case to operations or to whomever, saying, maybe we should work at, or to the Holden board perhaps, maybe we should work at trying to explain the difference between that we're very serious about water consumption. Not because of lack of input, but too much outgo. And therefore, sprinklers outside are totally different than what we want you to put into the sinks and the toilets. So I would be providing a vision about how you can keep doing the same thing, but maybe educating the people coming into the village. That would be spelling out in a sense of vision for the public official. So you provide facts or knowledge stuff to them. You provide some emotional, and I don't mean tearjerker, I mean, you provide a reason for it, in a sense. And then the third thing you might be doing, and these are all different types of things you might be persuading on, would be a vision of, you could change this. Give them an idea. The idea might be better than vision. In addition, those are the things that are providing the information. The emotional, the story, the connect with person appeal relates to the second thing you want to get across to a public official if you're trying to persuade them of something. Let's give them some motivation. To me, it seems the one we ought to use most often is, especially when you're a citizen trying to persuade them to do something, there may be much more powerful lobbying or other groups going against you. You may want to persuade them, do this not because it's something else, but because it's the right thing to do. So not only do you want to give them information, you want to persuade them that here's why you should do it. And I happen to think that that's can be, even with people you strongly disagree with, can be the most important thing. Persuade them because it's the right thing to do. Here's why I've given you this information. Cancellation of third world debt may not be politically popular, may not be this, but it's the right thing to do. Kids die because they don't have health care, because these countries spend more money paying off these unfair debts than they pay on their own health services. You want to tell them, do it because it's the thing you ought to be doing, because you want to do the right thing. And again, that's an assumption that most people in politics, is the case, want to do the right thing. They may have so many pressures that they may never do the right thing, but at least you appeal to them for doing the right thing. The other motivations you can use too, one of the obvious ones, it's politically smart to do. And that's, you know, you might get reelected, and frankly, most politicians don't stay in office unless they get reelected again. So it's politically smart to do. You want to do it. That's sort of the postcard campaign type of strategy. You know, a lot of us feel strongly about this, and the subtle implication is you want votes, do this. Related to this, but not exactly the same as politically smart, is you'll make people happy by doing that. Why do I say that's slightly different? Politicians kind of know in most cases that somebody sends them a postcard, dear, and these are a little more sophisticated than the ones that we used to get a lot of, dear Senator fill in the blank, I feel very, 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 very strongly about such and such and such and such issue. Sincerely, fill in the blank. Now, if I don't do exactly what they want on that postcard, are they going to remember they even sent the postcard? Are they going to know how I did vote on it? Are they going to know anything else? Probably not. So the idea that it's politically smart to do it, frankly, a lot of politicians realize that however they vote, it's not going to make that much difference. So what you want to do, which is related but a little different, is you want them to know people will be happy by them doing it. Why do I say that? Politicians, more than most people, want to make people happy. And that's why you have so many politicians who don't stand for anything, because the old line goes, well, how do you stand on this issue? Well, you know, some of my friends are for it, some of my friends are against it, and I'm with my friends. And politicians, well, we all tend to do that. You don't go to tell somebody, insult them to your face if you have any sort of tact. You tell them, you know, I really like how you do this, but could you maybe try and look at it this way? We try and get along with people, and politicians tend to be gregarious people, and they like people, and they try and please them. So letting them know, you know, I'd really like it if you do this, is a little bit different than saying it's politically smart to do that. But it is a motivating factor. And again, another possible motivation, it does work, but I'm not going to encourage it because it's a high risk. And it's sort of the converse of the, it's politically smart to do and it's politically stupid to do. And that's the kind of threatening, if you don't do this, I'm never going to support you. I get so many letters, I'm never going to support you again if you vote for this again, or if you do this or something. I thought, you know, you really got a kick out of that when some guy who came to my office was upset I was carrying a bill that would, it was an attempt to ban billboards by stopping all new billboards and capping the number we have and slowly phase them out, which about 4 states have banned billboards, about 4 others are in the phase-out stage. I was trying to do that here, and this guy, who I didn't know what he did, but he apparently ran an outdoor advertising business. He came to me and made it so clear that if I didn't withdraw this bill, he would do everything in his power to defeat me. I was going to say, that might possibly make a difference in some cases, but this guy, he's been writing letters, the editor attacking me, he's been co-chair of my opponent's campaign. He's been working against me for the last 10, 15 years anyhow. I mean, what kind of a threat is this? He's going to try hard to defeat me. What else is new? And if you, again, put yourself in the shoes of the person you're trying to influence, do you respond well when somebody threatens you, or do you dig in your heels and I'm going to stick it to them? There's a whole lot of that, which is why I'm not a big one on trying threatening behavior. And a whole lot of times, I sometimes save those letters, some of the really nasty ones that are entertaining, if nothing else. But politicians do have a lot of fear. They're afraid of losing their jobs. They're very scared of things that way. And fear can definitely be a motivating factor. But the more people express that in communication, the more I think it turns people off. You go to somebody and compliment them and say, you know, I really like what you did on this. We have a local city council member who I happen to disagree with a lot of the time, and he's a very nice guy. I don't get involved in city races. I got to work with whoever gets elected in these cities. But he happens to make all kinds of poor judgment. He's not the brightest guy in the world. The other day I was going to call me about something, and And before he could say anything, I had the chance to say, you know, I heard you had spoken out against this new thing. And I said, I really was glad to hear that, because I don't have many chances where I could compliment him. And I know he likes me, he supports me and everything. And I felt it was a good chance to put in a good word for him. I really like what you do on this. If there's anything good you can say about the person, I wonder if you could support this. That's a lot more encouraging to somebody like me, even if I don't think the person's a supporter, or don't know, or don't care. Nevertheless, that's more motivating to, I think, most people than the threatening type of thing. And again, with this concept of putting yourself in the shoes of the person you're trying to persuade, what would get to you if you were in their shoes? Use that. Stories. I mean, we're talking a lot. If some of you were down in the lift yesterday, hearing the storyteller. Our housemate up the hill, I asked her if she had been there at that part of the lift thing. She said, no, she missed the story. But I heard about it because her son had come home and retold this whole 15-minute story. Stories are memorable to us. Yesterday in Vespers, I mentioned the statistic, which somebody asked me in the buffet line a half hour ago. Was it 19,000 kids a day, you said? And yeah, that's right. And I was surprised the person remembered. I may have said that number two or three times, but numbers don't mean much to us. If I said 10,000, would that have been any less impressive? Or 5,000? No, they're all big numbers. I mean, they say one death is a tragedy. One death in an auto accident or something, oh, what a tragedy, and three deaths, and it can be just a horrendous calamity for a community, but 10,000 deaths is a statistic. There are no faces, no names, no anything else. People connect with stories. And so as part of communicating the facts, the emotional appeal, the ideas, whatever you're trying to communicate, the more you can relate it to stories. We're human beings and we're not numbers, and numbers can be useful at certain times, but tell stories. Think about what influences you and use that on whomever you're trying to influence. And I want to spend most of this time, and I know we're almost a third of the way done, I want to finish quickly with the ideas and then open it up for question and answer, because I think that's most helpful, especially on something like this. Part of the thing about providing information, again, the point this morning, this afternoon, if you're going to participate in that postcard campaign, the facts you provide, you're not really trying to communicate a lot of information. You're mainly trying to say, you know, here's why I feel strongly about this issue. Well, don't pretend to be an expert if you're not one. Frankly, very few of us are experts about very many things, and writing, sometimes I'll get a letter from someone who's clearly trying to make it sound like they know what they're talking about. And legislative language has all kinds of weird jargon. Some states have Senate bills, others have bill numbers, file numbers. Ours are Senate files. And they get something screwed up here or there, and it sounds pretty clear. They don't know what they're not an expert, and you don't expect them to be an expert. But the more they try and sound like they're an expert, and you know they're not, the more you get the sense that they were just reading some chart, which I picked up there, Jubilee information packet, and it's talking about the debt crisis, and here's how we can do this, and here we can do this, and here's some points you can make, and so on. The more you're using too much jargon, the more it's pretty obvious to the elected official, especially misusing jargon, which is very easy to do, and it's understandable, but the more it sounds like somebody was told to write this letter, and they filled out the letter, and the more it comes to their heart saying, you know, I'm worried about third world debt because these countries spend more money on debt payments for stuff that didn't benefit them in any way than they pay for their own health care and fighting the AIDS crisis or whatever. A short comment on that says you know enough about why you care about the issue, but it doesn't try and pretend you're an expert. And the converse of that, when you're contacting a public official, is don't assume, well, I don't know much about it, so I don't dare write a letter or don't do anything because I'm clueless, and they could argue circles around me anyhow and whatever. Frankly, on a lot of issues, you may know more than the elected official knows. I mean, it's reality. We're supposed to be experts in everything, like people who run Holden Village, who have to know a lot about sewage and about chemistry of mine tailings and about financial management and a whole bunch of other things they have to understand and know. And you can't be experts in everything. And while the average politician may be smarter than the average citizen thinks they are, there are a whole lot of people. I mean, when 30 years ago I thought one of the best quotes in American politics was one of Richard Nixon's appointments to the U.S. Supreme Court, which was not confirmed, defeated in the Senate. It was a judge from the South who most people attacked him for being a mediocre judge, and a U.S. senator from Nebraska said, "Well, mediocre people deserve representation too, and stupid people deserve stupid representation too." And there are, just like they're above average, they tell people about doctors, yeah, remember half the doctors graduate in the bottom half of their medical school. And that's a fact about politics too. Some are smarter than others, some are more informed than others, and nobody knows everything about everything. And frankly, about a lot of obscure issues, people write, if you wrote your U.S. representative about the third world debt thing, I couldn't speak, not working in Washington, for how many letters they've been receiving on that issue in the past. But there are a lot of issues like that that they're clueless on. They write, somebody writes, we get letters all the time on some issue, and, oh, you know, this issue is real troubling on architects, engineers. We have a board for that regulates and licenses that field. And, you know, I'm real concerned about this legislation do such and such and so and so. And the first thing my staff, I tell them, I'm clueless, I haven't heard about that bill, and they'll dig out the bill and figure out what's going on and so on. But the assumption that the elected official knows anything about what you're talking about isn't there either. So in the same way, don't pretend to be an expert. Don't, and again with don't using jargon and don't whatever, say, you know, I'm very concerned about the third world debt problem. A lot of these loans, these countries were loaned money, corrupt governments that we knew were corrupt, we loaned them money, they spent it on military or other personal things. It never benefited the people of that land. Those folks are long gone, but the country and the poor of that country are stuck with this. A two-paragraph explanation, if you're writing a congressman or somebody who may not know a lot about it, don't assume you're, well, I know you know all the details, so I'm just going to tell you vote this way. Fill them in. And start with the basics, and don't keep the message simple, and don't assume the elected official knows a lot about the issue. Even if they're smart, they don't know everything about every issue, and you might be the first one contacting about something. So when it's not part of a letter-writing campaign, start from the basic part. Sometimes we'll get a letter-writing campaign, we'll get a whole bunch of postcards on some issue, and they don't refer to any bill number or anything else, and usually that's not a problem. Minnesota passes gun law. Concealed carry is what it's been called. It doesn't require concealed handguns. It just is a permit to carry guns is made much easier to get. If somebody referred to concealed carry, or Minnesota Personal Protection Act, which is what the authors called it, or the gun bill, or this, or 10 other things, I'd know, I could feel what they were talking about. You don't need a bill number. Sometimes they'll refer to this thing about, you know, I'm really concerned about this pension thing and so on and so on. And they'll say a couple of sentences and which pension thing? We have hundreds of pension issues we deal with. So make it clear what you're talking about, but try to do it without using a lot of jargon. How do you communicate? Well, this is different levels. If you're trying to communicate with President Bush, your ability to call him up and chit-chat with him for half an hour is non-existent. If you're trying to persuade a local city council member of something, you know, that's probably the main way you're going to do it, is call them up and tell them what you think. So there are different ways of communicating, but you range from, in terms of one-on-one, I communicate with you, the public official, face-to-face. State legislators in most states, they live near the community. They live nearby. The districts aren't that big. I've got 80,000 constituents. 7 or 8 suburbs, and I don't know everybody in them. I don't know, but I know a lot of people and so on, and if somebody calls me up, I'm not trying to get more meetings with constituents. I got more than enough meetings and things to do. If they call my office, they like to talk to me. Well, they're more likely to talk to a staff person, more likely to do other things, but you know, if they really want to talk to me, they're going to succeed. At a local level, they're going to succeed without even trying. At a higher level, no matter how hard, try and contact the governor, you want to spend a half hour telling the governor your idea, you're not likely to get there. You may be lucky enough to be able to spend 15 minutes telling a staff person, or maybe a half hour, telling them what you want. But face-to-face is, I think, the most effective. We relate to people and we can see their reaction, and you can immediately respond to their concern. They look puzzled, you clarify it, so on. Face-to-face, phone call, maybe in some, I don't know if this is a great order of it, phone call, letters, postcards. Maybe this is in terms of ease of doing. Emails. I quote just out of the Resource Center, how to write members of Congress, United Church of Christ, filled with wonderful ideas. Type or neatly write your letter. Doesn't mention email here, and I looked in the back and it says a thing for January 30, 1993. Yeah, they didn't have a lot of email in January 1993. Things change over time. But email can be one of the best and one of the worst, and all the interest groups and every group trying to write things, they figured out email is a great way to flood things. More and more of my colleagues are getting to the point where they're, because you can't really tell. I don't respond just to people in my district, but I don't respond even to all of them. I try and read things that I think might have useful information, but when it's just easy, hit one button, some people program in every legislator's address, email address, and zap it to all of us, it looks like we're the only one getting it. So more and more legislators I know at our state level and at the congressional level, it's much more common. It's irritating to you sending it, but it says, if you want to send us a message, you email them. If you want to send us a message, please go to this website and fill out this form. You put your name, address, email address, and then in this box, put your message. Why do they do that? Why not just take a regular email? Because then you have to take a little bit of effort to do it, and not a lot more effort if you're going to write one person, but if you're blanket mailing everybody, you're going to have to, you can't do it to them. So that's a good way in a sense of sorting out. I haven't gone to that yet, but may have to because the number of emails you get. And when you do, put your name and address on it because Bubba Joe at AOL.com or something, well, who the heck is Bubba Joe and where does Bubba Joe live? Does he live in my district or live in Minnesota? Who is Bubba Joe? So you put your name on it, if your email address doesn't say your name, and your address, and so on. But emails, protect in going down some sort of ranking of simplicity, perhaps, petitions might be the next easiest. And sometimes somebody will come, I got 1,000 names on a petition. Well, I learned in college already when I and a bunch of friends, we had, I don't remember what the issue was, but we had petitioned the college administration, presented this petition with hundreds of signatures to the college president to show this is what the student body cared about. And he said, you know, I could take a petition and do the exact opposite, and I could get 100, 200, 300 names, depends how much work I want to put into it. People will sign anything. But nevertheless, that's a little exaggeration, but petitions can have an impact. And then, unrelated to these, dramatic actions. I've seen one time where there was a effort to shut down program for displaced homemakers, women, generally women, who had been homemakers for 20 years, spouse died or more commonly left them, just dumped them, and they had no way to make house payments. They had been out of the paid workplace for 20 some years, and there are several programs in Minnesota designed to help them quickly, many of whom were already well educated and so on, but to help them get their feet on the ground and start picking up the pieces to support themselves. Anyway, there was an effort to shut down those programs a couple years ago, and they took a petition which consisted of signing names and a little statement, and they did it on a thing where they then taped this together, and they had probably a mile-long petition of things which they wrapped around the Capitol Rotunda in here and ended up in the governor's office and dropped it off there and made nice news coverage, and people heard about it. So creative actions, drama, some people put a graveyard on our Capitol Mall last year on some things that were being cut to shreds, the law enforcement programs, other things, they made tombstones for them. visual impact can not just affect one member of a legislature or a body, but can affect a lot of protests, various types of things, some of which, many of which turn people off, when there's a loud rally in our Capitol Rotunda and they're pounding on drums and yelling, and there's a committee hearing going on, and it's kind of people grumble under their breath, I can't hear what's going on, and sometimes people in those protests try and be offensive, whatever, but there's a whole range of things. Face to face, the more effort you put into the communication, sometimes the better off you're going to be. And then I happen to think the volume approach is useful in some cases. Some people, again, those who are most fearful about their jobs, if they get 200 letters on something, they're going to, well, I mean, at the county board level, maybe 5 letters. Our level, if I get 20 letters on something, that's a significant amount. 2-3 years ago, churches started writing about concerns about homelessness in Minnesota. And we were getting, I think I was getting 40-50 postcards or letters, usually letters or emails and so on. And that was a sizable number. Some, most issues won't hear anything on. 2 or 3 letters can get attention at the state legislative level. Congressional office, you may have to get more if you're trying to do it by quantity to get somebody to notice. But the quality of it, the persuasiveness of it, I like the idea that not when you're doing a letter writing campaign, you don't have to take extra hours to be more thoughtful when they're going to get 2,000 letters and their postcards or emails and they're not going to read yours that carefully. But if you're calling or some other way, the more thought you can put into it, the better. And then finally, and before I get to opening it up, persistence and follow-through work. You know, if you write a letter, and this thing which had some very nice tips, I think they're more of them, they're type or neatly write your letter, be sure to get the correct spelling of your congressperson's name. Boy, when they can't spell your name right or whatever. Those are the little things that, just if you get a letter, it shows a little bit more respect or something. Also include name and address on the letter, or, and as I said, the email. Keep the letter brief. Yes, people don't have the time. Keep your visit brief. If you get a chance, if you just stop in, and can I have 2 minutes? If you ask for 25 minutes, in the middle of the day, it's not going to happen at any level. But if, if you're trying to meet with a member of Congress, if there's a staff person or something you can meet with for 10 minutes, that might be better than being able to just say hi and shake hands with the member of Congress for 10 seconds and not have a chance to talk anything with them. Be specific to your point quickly, state what you want, blah, blah, blah. Begin your letter by thanking them. Remember I made that point earlier, for recent vote or other actions you prove. This is not merely courtesy. It indicates you're a serious constituent who notices how they vote. Ask 1 or 2 questions. This is the one I wanted to pull this out for. Ask 1 or 2 questions which require more than a form letter response. You know, you write a letter and they go, oh, thank you so much for sharing your views on blah, 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 blah. I really appreciate this, and then I such and such. And being the politician, if you don't agree with the person, the easiest thing is, thanks for sharing your concerns. I'll keep your views in mind. But if you ask a couple questions, you know, do you feel that you can support this? And if not, could you support this sort of thing instead? I'd be interested in your whatever. If you ask a question or two, whether it's a staff person or the public official themselves, whatever level, filling it out, you can't do the same thing if there are questions you got to respond to. So try and be creative that way. See if any other points. Otherwise, I guess now is a good time to open it up. And this isn't, this may not be the most creative discussion type of forum thing, but I think there are lots of people who have questions. I've tried this and it worked, or I tried this and am I wasting my time or not? So I welcome, you know, whatever.
I'm just thinking about the postcards today. I saw the pre-print, pre-addressed ones. And if I were receiving these, if I received one where an individual had written the name and address on it, I'd give a lot more credence to that, that it seems it's was initiated by the person rather than one that's pre-printed that probably was handed out at church, and because you're a member of this congregation, right, please sign this and we'll put the stamp on it for you. And it doesn't really show any will.
Yeah, that's exactly what I was saying, the dear senator fill in the blank. They probably now know it, but 15 years ago when I started out, dear Senator fill in the blank, they'd get a very nice personal letter back, but frankly, it was as much attention put into it that they put into it. It was dear fill in the blank, and it was all done by, well, 13, 14 years ago, started being all done by computer. It was all the same letter, you just change the address and plug it in, and And for a long time, people didn't know. They thought they were getting a very personal letter from their elected official. Now I think a lot of people realize when they get this personal letter back, it's probably just a form letter they got back. And the more you send the postcard, the easier it is, because, oh, I get 20 pink postcards on this issue. Okay, put this in the pile for that standard letter. And it's a very simple thing to do. So even if you're part of a letter-writing campaign, the more you can do your own letter postcard, the better off it is. But I would argue that part of the point of a campaign like this would be, and frankly, in this campaign, I looked, I don't think I picked them up.
The postcard isn't pre-printed, just the address.
Yeah, just on it. And if it's a colorful postcard, when I said pink postcards before, yeah, we got, I don't know who had some light blue ones this year and somebody had some pink ones. To a certain point, if you know you're going to get a quantity of them, if this is a national initiative and there are lots of congregations and other groups who are doing it, if they start getting mailbags full in Washington of pink or green or whatever color postcards or whatever, that's the volume kind of thing. People really do care about this. And frankly, if I decide I'm going to take that postcard, throw it out and write a handwritten letter instead, if it's a case where they might read the letter, it might make a difference. On the other hand, it's one less postcard they get. So the main gist of those postcards is going to be quantity. But if they are just, if they're one color thing, and then here, write your own message, which is, I think, what they're doing here, that would be a step up in my mind from dear fill in the blank. It shows to me that somebody, even though it was initiated by somebody, it shows that at least I know enough about the issue that I can write three sentences or five sentences that sound somewhat coherent and give an argument why they want something. But the more effort you put in as a group or an individual, the better off you'll be.
Good answer, thanks.
Politics is kind of inherently disappointing in my experience. I spent the last 10 years doing a lot of lobbying in Washington. And the first years that I would do this, I would come home to Kate and say, I have to take a shower. This is terrible. I hate this. I'm disappointed. And, you know, I changed over time, though, and find that, you know, it's the art of the possible, in other words. Today we celebrate Jubilee. We read this thing by Yoder, John Yoder, which is a radical call. And the expression of the Christian faith here at Holden, in particular, I think, relative to my church at home, is radical. It is a new day in a fundamental way. We're talking about forgiveness of debt, not only in third world countries, but if we take Jubilee very seriously, you know, we're looking at fundamental change in our economic system here. One could argue that easily. Yet our politics is very polarized. You know, it's Sam Nunn, the guy from Georgia, the senator from Georgia, said, well, anything I've ever done has been good, has been bipartisan. It used to be we would look for win-win situations. Now it has to be I win, you lose. And that was absolutely my experience. I would never meet with Democrats, ever, in Washington. They were irrelevant. And in fact, if you go in and refer to some bipartisan support, some Democratic support for our social service agenda, it was a hit against you. The last thing you do is make reference to some bipartisan support. And trust is the coin of the realm in politics. You know, as you were saying, you don't respond well when you're attacked or there's a push against you, but rather you just try to discern who can you trust, who's going to like you, who's going to honor you. My question in all of this is, as a person of faith, and hearing this call for the radical Jubilee, and the call that, and the embodiment of the gospel in our world, how do you reconcile that? Is it disappointing? Is it, or what? And I'd be curious what other people think as well.
Okay. When you mentioned Yoder, I remember reading a book that 20, 30 years ago about a church in, I think it's Washington State, and I later on met at Holden, the pastor of the church, church who decided the biblical call was fairly radical in terms of what we're supposed to do towards the poor, and the church had just voted to approve a new education, a whole separate education building wing or whatever. This is 1970s, I think it was $1 million. And somebody in the congregation raised some point, and the pastor and everyone agreed, and what they did was they canceled the building project, and they decided to instead borrow money, as they were going to do to build the addition, borrowed $1 million and sent it overseas for development efforts, poverty relief development efforts. And they took out a mortgage, in effect, to give to the poor instead of help ourselves, in effect. In a recall meeting, the pastor here, impressive guy, and that's radical, and yet that may be what we're called to do. And while he's one church out of hundreds, and our church doesn't do that, and most others, and in the political realm, the same sort of thing. You decide, I mean, sometimes you're going to win everything you want, and then you miss 10%, I'm so disappointed and shocked and appalled, and other times you might be lucky to win 10%. Too many times I think the world is headed the wrong direction in our political systems. We're very short-sighted, very self-centered, and very disappointing. I like to distinguish, are you an optimist or pessimist? I'm a hopeful person. I think there's a big difference between hope and optimism. There's lots of times not. I don't think optimism is realistic, but there's always hope. And I mean, that's what a person of faith, I think, sees, that you quit doing it if you're losing ground unless you have hope that things might get better, and I hope that things will get better. I'm not sure, just a general reflection, I'm not sure that there's an... when we die, whether it's 2 years or 20 years or, I don't know how young people are, 70 years, I mean, it's 100 years from now, very few of us will be around. And when we die, will there still be poverty in the world? Probably. We hope not, but probably. If we give up on it, we can be sure there will be, but we're not going to solve all the world's problems by fighting for them. We know we're not going to even make progress on them if we don't fight for them. So I try and figure in terms of that you, sometimes it's a radical notion and you push as hard as you can, logically as you can. Maybe you shouldn't pick every fight. I sometimes think I get involved in too many things, but you pick the fight you can and fight as hard as you can for that, for what you believe in. Realizing you may lose. When you're doing something you believe in, you may know chances of losing are 98%, but you know there's that glimmer of hope, and that's why you do it. I don't know if that's exactly what you're getting at. And others want to comment on that too, because this is a democracy. I mean, people, when we tell people write letters or do this, tell your elected official what you want, well, then they should do it. I mean, I lots of times people who are experts in a field, maybe who work for a state agency, working on environmental concerns, and well, this way makes much more sense than that. It's going to be cheaper. It's going to be better this way. It's going to be better this way. They come to the Capitol and they tell a couple people, and well, now it should happen. And they're kind of appalled the first time they get there and they find out it didn't happen. Why didn't it happen? Well, just because it makes sense doesn't mean the political system is going to hear it as making sense, or there may be other pressures for a thousand other reasons why it's not going to happen. And so I don't assume it's going to happen because it makes sense. And your goal is to try and get it to the point where they see it making sense to do, and you may not have much of a voice to do it.
Well, don't you think change takes time?
Yes.
And at least the seed is planted.
And you know, close to 300 million people in our country. The fact that I feel very, very, very strongly about something doesn't mean that George Bush is or should do just because I do, because frankly, you might have the exact opposite opinion. You may feel just as strongly, and we're not all going to agree on things. It's a democracy in which we're going to disagree. And And so telling people that you pour your soul into this thing and the government doesn't change. That's why the more you fight battles at your local city hall, you have a better chance of winning them. They're much more manageable, and one person makes a lot more difference. Battles may be more important and affect more lives, more bigger issues at the state level or the national level, but again, it's proportionally harder because there's so many people you're competing against, in a sense.
I have a question along that line up here.
Okay.
Obviously, if you write a letter or talk to somebody on a local level, you're going to get that message to them personally. By the time you get to, say, someone like you on the state level, or moving on to the congressional and national level, who's reading what we write?
Okay.
I mean, obviously, at some point, you simply can't, as right. the elected official, deal with the volume of mail you're getting. So how do we know that what we're writing is even being somehow conveyed?
Anybody's seeing anything.
Yeah.
Yeah, mm-hmm. That's a good point. And with email, while it's the easiest thing to do, it's also the hardest to measure. And frankly, that's why I think within 5-10 years, anybody you're writing letters to on email, at least elect government officials and so on, any corporate thing you do, if you're contacting some business about something that's broken or something, they always have you click in, type in your name, address, email address, phone number, and then your message. Mm-hmm. You can type it on the word processing thing and cut and paste it, and then you can do it to several officials at the same time. So there are ways to sort of get around it. But how do you know it's getting through? You may not. But let me assure you, at the state level, and again, there's a big difference if anyone's here from California, New York, is a lot different from Minnesota or Washington State, or certainly much different from New Hampshire or Idaho and much lower population states, where legislators have a lot smaller constituencies. New Hampshire state representatives, I think there are 400 state representatives in New Hampshire. I think there are about a little over a million two or something people in New Hampshire. There, each of them is representing roughly 3,000 people or less. That's tiny. That's small town city council member may represent 3,000 people, and they probably know majority of their constituents.
So they might read their own.
They will have to read everything. In our state, I would guess, I have 80,000 constituents.
So who reads your mail?
I read a lot of it. I mean, if I have 50 identical emails or letters on an issue, I'm not going to read each one all the way through. I have staff that does that, and I don't, this year for the first time I decided some letters where people are just anti something or another and I'm disagreeing with them anyhow, I thought, well, maybe I won't bother to respond to them. Some legislators, I remember one guy who, a number before I got there, the secretary who had been there a long time, said that this guy had not answered any of his mail all session long. It was like a big stack this high, and she said, Senator, now that the session's over, can I help you? Because this is 30 years ago, they were shared staff for legislators. Can I help you with clearing that off? He said, no, I don't need any help. You sure? There's a lot of mail. There are a lot of people. No, it won't take me long. And he put up a wastebasket, recycled bin, and just pushed the bin in there. That's one approach for other people who carefully read everything. That is a true story that does happen in some cases. So writing a postcard or a very long, thoughtful letter won't make a bean's worth of difference in that case. But we're dealing with the fact that most people don't do that. And most, in California, state senate district, I think they have like 52 members of Congress, each of which represents over 500,000 people, like 40 state senators. So each of them is representing well over 500,000 people. At that level, that's a totally different thing than the New Hampshire legislature with 3,000 people in their house. But most state legislators, very good chance, if they don't see it directly, there are very few legislative staffs in anything but the biggest two or three states are bigger than two or so people per legislator. And your message will get through there, and you write a personal note saying this, or you call. Try calling. You'll find out what kind of response you get. lots of Minnesota legislators, they'll pick up the phone. I will sometimes, depending what I'm doing. They'll pick up the phone and you may talk with them or say, can they call you back? And sometimes the bigger states, you're more likely to get a staff person call you back. But yes, at the state legislative level, you still get people pay attention to it. And when they're at home, ask, call their office and say, when you live in a part of the state that's not near the Capitol, ask if you could meet with them sometime, and sometime when they're back home in the district. Depends the issue, how strongly you feel about it, and so on.
So the larger the constituency, the more chance it is that your letter would be read by a staff person
rather
and then,
than that.
And then someone would have to relay that to...
Yeah, but even there, it's going to tend to be read when you get to U.S. Congress, and again with 9/11, when they stopped taking mail for a while altogether, they said email us or whatever else because of anthrax. I don't know what practices are there now, but a whole lot of people, I've seen people who are really angry because they write a letter on one thing and the elected official writes a letter back on a, they missed the point. And very clearly, whoever plugged it into the computer didn't do it. And in that case, it's not having as much impact. But they tend to, a lot of those folks actually count the mail. I'm saying, I mean, they don't literally weigh the mail, but boy, we're getting a ton of mail on this side.
At that point, volume counts.
Volume can count. But again, at lots of levels, it does have an impact. And again, if you've got a U.S. senator or somebody else, it doesn't mean you can't have an impact. Again, persistence pays off, calling there and asking us to talk to the staff member who this and... the more effort you put into it, and the more of you working together, you as one individual, if you've got a brilliant idea and you've got the right persistence and right other things, you could have something happen on it. Otherwise, the more people you have working on an issue, the better, and the more persistent you as an individual are, the better.
I have kind of two areas I'm concerned about. Maybe you can spread some light on it. First is this, like when a bill kind of collects new unrelated items, and I don't know what the word is they call that, but
various states have different terms: garbage bill, Christmas tree.
And you know, how do you, you know why, first of all, why do they do that? You know, why sometimes they're totally unrelated items, it seems like, and you know, a vote yes could mean
50 bills.
You know, bad for one thing and good for another in one person's view. And so I sort of have, you know,
why is it happening? What do you do about it?
And then the second question is, area is about, you know, is it a common practice, you know, to, in order to convince other people to vote on your thing, do you make
trades? Log rolling or whatever they call it in various states. On the first one, first of all, you know, Minnesota, they're usually called garbage bills. To a certain point, that's a function of bicameral, a two-house legislature. Everything in society is ruled by single governing boards, Holden Village Board. Any nonprofit has a board of directors. Any corporation has a corporate board, school board, city council. Everything has one body that makes the decisions, except, even the British Parliament, while it nominally has two houses, it's basically a one-house thing. The U.S. Congress, for a variety of reasons that make some sense or made some sense at the time, is a two-house legislative body. And the states, all but Nebraska, have the same thing. City councils, used to be a lot of bicameral city councils. Now there's two or three in the country, and Canadian provinces, I think virtually everyone's gone to a one-house, one-body strategy. And I'd argue that's a good thing because, yeah, while the textbook political science is, the Senate catches mistakes of the House or vice versa, because you have, if you just think about how it works, you have a body of people come and make some decisions. If you had two Holden boards, the one Holden board's going to decide, we're going to spend this much on this and this and this and this, and we're going to have this policy towards fires, towards guest days, towards this, towards how much we're going to devote to this. Resource questions and policy questions, you've got thousands of decisions to make.
board makes a decision, then you got another board making different decisions. And the way negotiations work in each one, you come to some sort of consensus in both. Then you got to merge them and get them the same. And so what do? You, okay, well, we'll trade this budget item for that policy item. And so there's some natural problem with that that's going to happen. The U.S. Congress is never going to change. I keep thinking some year states may change. Nebraska did during the Depression, partly as a cost-saving measure. I favored doing it in Minnesota for a long time. Not when I got there, but after I was there for a while, I thought we'd be a lot more thoughtful. So many times, oh, don't worry about it, we'll fix it in conference committee. And people throw in garbage or ornaments or whatever you call them, unrelated things in conference committee, so we get things passed. I think it's a terrible practice. This year I had a bill on, it was related to privacy issue, a government data issue on open meetings. And I had been pushing hard for several years, and the person in the House who was authoring the bill also authored this bigger data practices bill, and he folded it in there. I thought, what a relief. Now I don't have to keep fighting to get it through and get more hearings. It's in this big bill, and chances are it's going to make it, and it did. And frankly, with these unrelated provisions, that's the biggest way of campaign dirt. When you try misleading information, you can use almost anything to prove somebody's voted for something they didn't support, or vice versa. And politicians can use it likewise to disclaim responsibility. Oh, well, yeah, I know it was in there, but I had to vote for it because other things in the bill, and frankly, they may have supported it. So it makes the system much less accountable. It's a real problem. And sometimes they may be related things, and you like some provisions in the bill. McCain-Feingold campaign finance reform bill, overall 90% of the bill I thought was great. But at the same time, a little provision on the other end, doubling the amount of hard money, the direct campaign contributions you can make to a person, was doubled. I think it was a major mistake. But I didn't have a vote on that issue, and even if I did, I couldn't have changed it. And so I think it was one significant, not major, but significant step forward, and one significant step backwards. That's part of the legislative process. It's not healthy, it's not great. Sorry about that, it's the way it is. Log rolling, the concept about trade this for that, it happens a lot. I don't like doing that, and I've lost some bills because, well, if you'll support this, then I'll say, well, no. I don't happen to do that. I think most people do. I suppose it's not the most sinister thing in the world. I think the trouble with it is, I could make arguments in many cases that on balance this makes sense to do here. The trouble is, where do you draw the line? And it's not a good practice, but it happens in probably any legislature.
Are the Christmas trees, those are amendments we're talking about, aren't they?
Often they're amendments. Sometimes the bills are put together that way because, again, because of the two-house system, you can't pass a bill for funding special education and a separate bill for funding K-12 in these schools, and then this one for school transportation. You have one education finance bill, and you have a broad area of things, so you put that together, and then, well, it's sort of an education policy and that, so you put in some policy things, because is this policy or is this budget? Because it has a budget impact, so you throw them together that way. So many of those are put together as a bill that way. Many others come as amendments, and often in our legislature, and I don't think it's good practice, but there will be an omnibus education finance bill with a lot of policy things in, and the House will have passed its version of it. And then they had some other things that weren't quite related to it, but they had something to do with school board elections. So they put that in the bill. And because they figured it's, but that may have passed the full House too. They'll say, well, the full House passed both of these, and the Senate hasn't taken up this bill, so we'll fold it in here. And then we in the Senate, sometimes becomes take it or leave it. It's not a good practice, but sometimes they're amendments, sometimes they're part of the bill, just because you don't want to have 1,000 different budget bills. We have about 8 of them or so. Education, higher education, environment, agriculture, and so on. We have one for state government agencies, we have one for taxes. All the budget things develop into about 8 categories, and so tens of thousands of funding items and revenue raising and
tax policy related things come in about 8 different single bills, some of which can be 700 pages.
Are there any conversations about a solution to this, a better practice?
Yeah, well, I mean, I've tried to push the idea of a unicameral system just because of that. This year, when I mentioned the school board election provision being put in on a budget thing, the House Minority Leader in Minnesota put on a provision to basically repeal major party status for the Green and Independence parties. And I actually was sort of offered the provision that put it in there, the thing that allowed them to qualify at the time, and this guy decided to take it out of there. And I don't have strong feelings, even though I authored it, I don't have strong feelings if they want to take it out. But taking it out with no notice, no hearings, is a floor amendment to the education bill. I saw this and I thought, you know, this is clearly not germane. And our state constitution says bills shall be of a single subject. And I got out some court rulings. I got our Senate, one of our Senate attorneys, to dig out some rulings on it. I wrote a letter to all my colleagues saying, you know, basically one that wanted to make sure the courts and everyone would see if they didn't change it, and says, this is clearly unconstitutional, and the courts are likely to throw out this whole thing. We'll be back in a special session. I sent that to the parties that were involved, the Green and Independence parties. They started coming in saying, we're going to sue if you don't take this out. And whether it was my letter or their lawsuit threat, I think it was the latter, sure enough, we passed a little amendment, a bill to repeal that part of the law that hadn't even passed yet because it was clearly unconstitutional. And I keep trying to ride people and saying, look, we got the constitutional prohibition, trying to say, let's just throw out anything the House, because our House puts in a lot of that. That's kind of a discipline thing, but we have to change the structure, I'd argue, and we also have to have more discipline. And that's individual legislators saying, even if I like some things, this isn't the way to do it. But there's no easy answer. We have to quit about now, actually. I'm happy to stay around, because this is the kind of thing that if, during the course of the day or the week, if you have other, you know, I tried this in our local community, we tried this on such and such issue, would that do any good? I'm happy to try and answer those to the best of my knowledge, and this is a pretty subjective area. We're trying to figure out how you change people's minds. But it's worth trying. It's very much worth, if you care about an issue, and I think we all have a lot of things we care about, the only way you're going to make a difference is to change who's in office or change how the people in office view things. And you can do the second one sometimes easier than the first one, but they're both worth fighting for. So thank you for your attention.